to take any more time from the message he's going to have for us. I want to give you Dr. Luke of Youngstown High.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, Honorable Secretary of State, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Luke Reed. I'm a cardiologist. I'm a medical witness. I'm 55 years old. I'm an alcoholic in the menopause. Besides this, I think I'm about as funny as a crutch. Tonight, as I was shaving and Harriet was doing those things beside me in the preparation for the evening, I said, by golly, I should have had a haircut. She looked and she said, yes, you could have stood one. I said, oh, well, this way maybe I'll look a little hep. I'll look like the kid. She said, well, you're going to have to take a hell of a lot more of those hormones and vitamins before you look like one of the Beatles. I'm real flattered to be asked to come down here. This is a long way, and I suppose the further you go, the more distinguished you get. I was thinking as I went along the river yesterday and looked up on the hill, I saw a little outhouse. I was thinking of the famous West Virginia veteran of Korea who came home bedecked with many honors, Legion of Merit, Legion of Honor. He had trunks full of souvenirs, silks, jade, hand grenades, everything. He had a lot of money, too. He traded a lot of cigarettes, and he was pretty well loaded. So, a couple of days around the house, he was real upset about the primitive things at home. He'd been in the big cities, and he'd seen a lot of the comfort. So, he started to heckle the folks about inside plumbing. Mother and Dad weren't very enthusiastic about it, and this bothered him. He did what he could in the way of persuasion, but nothing came. There was no encouragement. So about the third night home, he wasn't sleeping too well, and he looked out the window, and in the moonlight, he saw this tilted old outhouse. He thought, well, here's my chance. So he dug around in the closet and dug out one of those big, long Japanese grenades and sneaked downstairs out on the back porch, pulled the pin, and heaved it. It hit the outhouse with a resounding thud, and, of course, the thing blew up in the air, and his dad came tearing down the stairs. He said, my God, what have you done? He said, well, we're going to have inside plumbing now. He said, I've taken care of that. He said, but your grandpa was in the air. So they rushed out and dug around in the rubbish and the mess which they found, and the old man crawled his way out and rubbed his eyes and said, by God, it's good I didn't cut her in the parlor. AA with me is serious business. It's like sex. What else can you do and have so much fun without laughing? Really, though, AA is a very, very serious business with me. I'm going to take a few minutes to qualify myself. I'm sure that you don't mistrust that I'm qualified. I wouldn't come here and have so many friends who invite me if I were a phony. I'm a real drunk. I'm just exactly like any of the rest of you and any of the rest of the thousands who circulate. AA is my life, without which I'm dead. There's no question in it. Those years which I now have and have had for the last 8 years, I owe to AA. I'm sure I would have been dead soon had it not been. I'm fortunate that I found approximately 8 years ago, and I would say in my case life begins at 47. I give you a little background, a little history of my life. I came of plain and common people. My dad and mother were Hoosiers. Dad left the people that adopted him and took a carpet bag or a canvas sack with all of his worldly possessions and went to Washington, worked through high school, worked all his way through college, and he became a school teacher. He graduated from Purdue, and he worked in the industry during the war in Indiana and World War I, came to Ohio to teach, and that's where I grew up, mainly in Youngstown, Ohio. Mother was a musician and gave me a little natural talent in that respect. I was a good kid, I think. I was an only child. In our limited means, I was given some piano lessons as a kid. I carried magazines and paper out. So that I knew very early in life the meaning of a dollar, the meaning of a penny. I was fairly fortunate as a student. I didn't have too much trouble getting through school, and all the way through school I made good grades. Even at about 14 or 15, I was playing professionally with dance orchestras. I got in the musicians' union when I was 15 because we were competing with professional musicians in the community to the point they'd rather have us on scale than competing at scab wages, so I was in the business for a long time, and in fact, I kept my union dues up until I finished my internship. As a piano player, I sat on the bench, and during those lovely days of prohibition, we were partly paid in kind. I played in all sorts of joints, speakeasies, and other houses of disrepute in which they needed music. And so that it is not a strange thing for me at the age of 17 or 18 to be sitting playing tunes at the request of the drunken customers and have seven or eight bourbon and sodas lined up on the top of a baby grand piano along the music rack. I learned to drink and scale my drinking. I never fell off the piano bench. I'm Scotch by descent. I always wanted to be around when they passed out the skins or the money at the end of the deal. And I never failed to be in for the payoff. It never occurred to me that alcohol was much of a problem. It was for fun. I drank like the kids. I drank like musicians. I played with older musicians, usually, and as you well know, this is a common practice among show people, dancers, stage people, and musicians, to drink. I was lucky in college, certainly no problem with drinking. I played piano every day for my meals and for money on the side. I paid my way through college, paid a good deal of the way through medical school. I was on the honor roll. I was a 5'8". I only tell you this because I wonder how a 5'8 can be so damn dumb as I was, as life unfolded itself in the years which followed. In medical school, we learned about alcohol very briefly. It was a carminative, it was a mild stimulant. In large enough doses, it was mildly depressive. In an entirely different section of the book than the habit-forming drugs, even the barbiturates. Alcohol was discussed as a sort of a useful medical vehicle. Certainly it is a vehicle for many, many medications. It's a solvent in which many of the drugs and things that we use, terpene, hydrate, and so on, dissolve readily in alcohol. Many of the tonics, iron and other tonics which you use, and these things are dissolved in alcohol, and this is the best vehicle for them. So that alcohol actually is a useful liquid and actually is a useful drug. It helps, assists in many conditions, and in people who can take it, it helps them in many ways, as you know. In medical school, I almost quit. A couple times I got discouraged, not so much about booze, but I had a chance to go on the road and be a musician again, and I think only $25 divided me from leaving and going on a stage around with a night band that I wanted to play with very badly. And, however, I stayed in medical school. As an intern, I was getting in trouble then, a little bit. Mostly with me. I didn't come to the attention of the authorities. I never almost got kicked out like some of my friends did in the hospital training. I was in one hospital in Boston during prohibition, and for social purposes, we were drinking alcohol, of course, with juniper and anything else we could use to disguise the color and taste. And the boss wanted to make some studies on fluid intake. This was a brain surgery service at Boston City Hospital, where we admitted about 5 or 6 drunken Irishmen every 24 hours with fractured skulls. In South Boston, they settle all arguments with a brick. And so every morning we operated from about 8 till 12, just opening skulls and taking out blood clots. And usually they were O'Toole's and McGinty's and so on in South Boston. The problem was to determine whether these drunks needed fluid or not. In those days, it was a question, did this fellow need fluid or did he not need fluid? How much had he taken of liquid and kept before? This is water balance study, and the boss wanted to know something about this. So I volunteered, and he bought the booze. This meant that I went out 2 or 3 nights in a row and got real drunk and came in, and they put skin tests up and down my shins with an intradermal needle to see whether or not vomiting or whatever else might have happened would affect the level of my fluid and whether or not this was a reliable test. So I was a guinea pig and a very much of a volunteer to it, particularly since somebody else bought the booze, and this got me out of a few days of work. I think maybe these are indications of a beginning tendency. All my friends by this time, including my beloved wife that I started to court about that time, all of my friends were either alcoholics or likely to become alcoholics, because this is the only company I really enjoyed. I went to Youngstown and started to practice. I was lucky they needed doctors badly, and in the years just preceding that, I was aware that the drinking was getting serious, but I had some sort of an idea like I'd had previously about alcohol, that I couldn't become addicted to it. I felt it was not addictive. I felt that my Hippocratic oath and my devotion to my practice, once I got into the responsibility of a private practice, these things would all take care of this unfortunate tendency that I was developing. In other words, I had every other night out, and every other night I was drunk. So that the day following this, I was not very useful to myself or to anybody else. I suffered, and I don't have to tell you what I suffered. You all know. Trying to work and making some sort of a show, and still pretty much determined to make something of myself, because I had nothing to count on. I had no security or anything behind me except what I was to make for myself. So I became an alcoholic by accident, I think, like most everybody else. I enjoyed drinking. I thought that nice people drank. We've always been led to believe from movies and what we read in the books and so on that cocktail drinking and champagne and these things are associated with the better way of life, with successful people. So I wanted to be successful, and I wanted to keep pace with the Joneses. So we drank some more. We drank a better grade when I could start to pay for a better grade. We got on scotch. That was more expensive and more dignified. I did very well in practice, and I didn't drink at work, despite the fact I'd get awfully drunk at night and get awfully drunk on weekends on some occasions. I think the Lord or some higher power must have been looking after my patients, not me, because now, to my knowledge, I didn't make any serious mistakes. or do anybody any serious harm as a result of my upgrowing habits. These are grim stories that go from here. We had family trouble. We have three lovely children now, and they were lovely then, only we didn't appreciate them. They got so they wouldn't eat with us. You don't need to know why. It was because we didn't eat till about 9 o'clock after a 4-hour cocktail hour. And they gradually, more and more withdrew from us and went to their rooms and ate. And a thorough bit of drunkenness, I bought a 22-room house. And we still live in it, as a matter of fact. We somehow adjusted to it. Our kids are all gone now, and we have three dogs, so Harriet and I wander this place. We can't afford to sell it, and we can't afford to keep it. At any rate, this is one of the things that harks back to those good old drunken days. I went in the Army, and there was the usual hysteria that preceded that. In the first place, they wouldn't take me because of some scars on my lungs and so on. This made me mad. I really wanted to go then. So I signed waivers and finally got in. We lived the merry-go-round of the officer club and so on. I had good rank all the time, and I had good jobs because I had certification specialists. So they needed specialists with board American Medical Association recognition. So I went in as a captain, and I became a lieutenant colonel. And compared to what I had done before in civilian life, the time required was about 2 hours a day. Compared to what I had been doing in a very busy practice, the Army doesn't require too much time to do most of what is essential. It allowed a lot of time for drinking, and I had a lot of need for time for drinking at this point. So it went as you would expect. We lived in the desert on the what is now Edwards Air Base for 2 years. I had access to plenty of alcohol, and we'd go in to Hollywood where we had some musician and show people friends, and always load the car up with all sorts of brandy and junk. We preferred bourbon, but it was hard to get it, you all remember, in 1943. And we were not too choicy at this time, as you know. I drank plenty of alcohol, spiked beer from the base, and so it was that sort of thing. While I was there, did pretty well, but I got into trouble with the big boss, and I finally got bounced, and I did come to White Sulphur Springs for a short sojourn of about 8 weeks on my way to Japan. This is the way you got rewarded in my capacity, was to be sent overseas, and I was on the ocean when they bombed Hiroshima. Anyway, I got lost in Japan, and this, of course, was a kind of a mess. My American wife, though, at that time was back in Youngstown, and she was getting herself hooched up while I sat in Japan with nothing to do but drink and trade cigarettes for yen and yen for hooch and kimonos and stuff. And it was pretty bad. I missed some of the nice things that I should have seen. And when I got home, everything was pretty bad. I by this time had a real first-class resentment because there had been a lot of other doctors got home with more points than I had and got home sooner, and I hated them, of course, because they were making money and I had been starving and so on. So all of these things piled up into that alcoholic resentment which I already had, and these were inflammatory material to add to the fire. I'd only been open, only had my office open 2 weeks, and I had the go-down months, and this, of course, was associated with encephalitis, so that I had headache and was out of my head for about 3 or 4 days. And they gave me some plasma to try to relieve some of the situations, and I'm allergic, so I developed an acute allergy with asthma and urinary shutdown and the whole business. But when the smoke cleared after this mess, I had a headache that lasted for about 3 or 4 months, and I couldn't tell what part of the headache was due to whiskey. It seemed worse than the usual headache, so I was pretty confused and I got pretty depressed. And my family got concerned because I kept cleaning my 45 all the time. I did. Spend my afternoon off instead of going out with the boys and playing poker or doing something natural, I'd re-clean the 45. And sit in my underwear in my bedroom all afternoon, steamed and cleaning the 45. So they got me to go and see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist that I saw in Cleveland, naturally, was one of my friends, and my friends were all alcoholics. So he did what he could. I went up for 12 treatments at weekly intervals, and each time I'd leave my office and make it to Cleveland in about an hour. You can't do it in less than an hour and a half, but I did. I would see him at his office. We'd talk for 45 minutes at the prescribed psychiatric appointment. He would then open the bottom drawer and pull out a fifth, and we'd drink it out of the neck, as all good alcoholics do. No glasses, no water. But Mac and I had interned together, and this was an old thing with us. The few years that had elapsed between didn't make any difference. Well, unfortunately, Mac is dead. He didn't find AA, and he found some of the things that were wrong with me, but he overlooked alcohol. He found out that I had a situation with regard to my mother. It had something to do with nursing or something like that. He found there were some things wrong with Harriet that I agreed with him on. But he did say I shouldn't divorce her, I shouldn't sell or buy any stock, I shouldn't change my office location, I shouldn't change my type of specialty. In one fit of emotion, I said to him, "Well, Max, am I fit to practice on people? Am I safe in this depressed state of mind?" Oh, he said, "Hell, you're all right with other people. Your only trouble is with yourself. Just, you're, in an objective way, you can give other people good advice, but don't take any of your own advice because it's bad." So this was one of those things which many of us have been through. Mac, of course, couldn't learn anything about alcoholism because he didn't admit he was an alcoholic. He had a little heart condition, but actually he died of alcoholism, not of his heart. When I was through with this course of treatment, being a close friend, I knew he charged about $35 an hour for treatments, $35, and I knew enough not to ask him for a bill because he wouldn't send one. So, appropriately enough, the last day on the way out, I was trying to think what I should do. I hadn't thought of it before. I could have bought him something at a jewelry store, something that would be right, you know. But on the way up, it occurred to me, well, this is my last trip. I'd better do something nice. So I stopped in Cleveland Heights and bought a case of Old Granddad. What would be more typical for an alcoholic? Anyway, I delivered after our meeting, I said, "Mac, I have a little gift for you in the car." And he said, "Let's stop by the house then." And I stopped by the house. So we knocked off one of the fifths, and I came on home as usual. I always stopped at a halfway point between Cleveland and Youngstown anyway. It was called a Pittsburgher. I never knew just why it was halfway between Cleveland and Youngstown. But they sold doubles reasonably, and I had always accustomed myself to stop there in those days. Well, all of this hassle went on, and I'm not going to take you through the grim details. I'm a little different from some alcoholics that you hear. I was never locked up. I was never in a straitjacket. I never actually had DTs. I never wrecked a car. I didn't quite get a divorce. But we hit a bottom, and the bottom came to me, I think, because I knew I was going to die. Now, how bottom can you get? All these other things may be important. I wasn't under the bridge, and I hadn't poured sterno through a loaf of bread yet, but I had reached the point where I no longer had any control. I no longer had a choice about what I would do with alcohol. I thought that our friends that we associated with, I thought these people were all alcoholics. We didn't go with anybody else who didn't drink. you couldn't get me out to a party, a dinner party or anything where there wouldn't be whiskey. I had come to the point that I wouldn't go to a funeral or go to a funeral home or go to a wedding, and of course I wouldn't think of going to a medical meeting without being steamed. In other words, I had done this over a long period of time. I had developed a beautiful and a large tolerance. About the only time I passed out was when I determined to pass out. That is, the last thing before I fell into bed. Or when I was ready to fall down, then I polished off the glass bowl that did it. Up to this time, I could drink at a pace, and this I always did, but I stayed quite well embalmed. I was the tolerance. I reached a level of nearly a fifth a day. I did not drink in the office. Kind of hard to understand how you can drink a fifth between 4 o'clock and the time, 4 p.m. and the time you go to bed, but I could do it. I did many, many times. I enjoyed a nice lucrative position as a consultant in a nearby hospital in Salem, Ohio, which incidentally I still have. And I never drove my car without a fifth of whiskey in the back. I'm back with the spare tire. I had a fifth with an unbroken seal on it. I didn't like to drive with an open bottle for fear I might get into trouble on that account. The distance from Salem was 22 miles. I'd go to Salem 3 or 4 days a week and see patients for other doctors and consultations. I had an extra key to the rear end of the car as soon as I'd leave Salem. I didn't stop at bars because I didn't dare have these people know that I was a drunk. As soon as I'd get out of town, I'd get the key out, leave the motor on, go out and get my fifth, break the lid on it, and between there and Youngstown, I would knock off half of it. I couldn't come home without it. I couldn't get through a day without it. I can read my cardiograph. I knew what was going on with my heart. I knew what was going on in a lot of ways. I was losing my kids, losing my wife. I still made enough money to keep all this business going. And I knew that the axe was going to fall. Someday I was going to break both legs or break my neck and stay alive, perhaps, and have to stay awake and watch this terrible thing come to pass. I remembered when I finally came to AA. 10 years before this, a young man came to my office for life insurance, and I examined him late in the evening. This was just after I got home from Japan. This young man said in response to the question on an insurance form, "Do you or did you ever drink to excess, or have you ever been treated for alcoholism?" He said, "Well, Doc, I don't know what to say." He said, "I'm an AA. I belong to a group in State College, Pennsylvania. This fellow's only 35 years old." And at that time, this was pretty young for people in AA. At any rate, I said, "Would you mind waiting till I see a couple of more patients? I want to ask you some questions." So 10 years before I got to AA, I'd bent this boy's ear for at least a half an hour, and I don't remember what really came of it. Nothing for a long time, but at least I must have been feeling at that time that someday I was going to have to holler for help some way. Because some of the things he said I must have remembered, because in the back of my mind I knew that somewhere there was a little hope for me. I'd done all of the standard things that you do, you know. I thought about moving from Youngstown. I have a license in California. I almost moved to California to practice. I changed my brand. I didn't like gin, so I'd switch around from gin to beer and all these things other than bourbon, hoping that this might cut down. Well, you know how futile all these things are. I got to go into church at another place, and I even thought of converting to Catholicism, and I thought maybe if I divorced my wife or changed my car, the type of car I drove, or and then I thought of maybe taking up a new specialty at the age of 45. And all these things that every alcoholic does, you romp around and try to find some solution for the mess that you're in and the agony that you're going through. The fellow who gave me my first real pitch was Neil Kennedy. He He's now deceased. Many of you have heard of his name, and he would like to have me mention his name because he was anything but anonymous. Neil was sort of the dean of AA in Youngstown many years. I called him. I knew him. I said, I want to talk to you. He said, can you come tomorrow? I'm just ready to go out and see a man that's working on my yard. I said, yeah, I can come. That night I put Harriet and one of the kids on the airplane for New York. And believe me, I got bombed. I was really out of it and passed out when I got back home. But I had to go to Warren and see a consultation the next day. So when I walked into Neil's office around 11 o'clock, the assigned time, I was shaking every place. And the fact that I was an MD and supposedly know something about disease and the body and the functions and so on, I was as scared as any of you have ever been trying to face this crisis. And here somebody tells me to worry about the next 20 minutes and let everything beyond that go. This is kind of hard to do. This is a big change. But I was on my knees, and I think if he told me to walk through the public square in my underwear, I would have done it at this point because I thought I had to. I had to stay alive. He told me that it was a selfish program and that I should do it for myself. And this makes sense to me because God knows I'm selfish. And I was able to realize that if I could determine to get sober for myself and not to get sober for these other things I ought to get sober for, my lovely wife, my nice home, and my three fine children, and a good practice, and my heritage, and so on, all these good things that I should get sober for. You know how important this is to a drunken alcoholic. You just don't get sober for those things. It seemed sensible to me to get sober for me, and this was the kind of the philosophy I worked on then, and I've sort of done it ever since. The other things that come, that need to come afterwards, have come with me, and I think they come with everyone. The important thing is to get this fellow through the first day and through the first week and the first month. Those days are long and tedious and hard, and if you're getting through those, and then after a while the years move pretty fast, and they aren't so tough and so trying. One of the things that I did immediately, and I think I've done ever since, and I'm sure it's important to me, I'm a hypertensive, accelerated sort of an individual, and I'm impatient, I'm egotistical, I have all of these faults, or virtues, look at it however you will. Sometimes our faults work as virtues. I have these qualities, and I don't think I became an alcoholic because I'm a dimwit or because I am a psychopathic individual at all. I think I'm fairly well-rounded in my understanding of most things. I haven't been psychoanalyzed, but I've had small pieces of psychoanalysis done to the point that basically I don't think there are any great underlying psychopathic conditions. And yet I'm an alcoholic as sure as they ever come. I've done everything, and I have all of the qualities, and I have absolute certainty in my own mind that I cannot today or tomorrow or ever in my life drink safely and comfortably. I might be one of those very, very rare exceptions, but I'm not willing to take the chance. One of the things which occurred to me very soon after I started to go to meetings and got in the program was the fact that tranquility without excitement cannot last. Just to be peace, just to have peace of mind and have it uninteresting and dull wasn't going to last for me, and I don't think it'll last for anybody. You've got to do a lot of things. You've got to be active. You've got to make a new life. Here I was with a lot of time. Here was in my practice days, I was working about 40 hours a week. I was drunk about 40 hours a week, and I was getting well about 40 hours a week, licking my wounds. So here I am with 80 hours at least that I'd wasted before. Now what am I going to do with them? This is a big problem for a lot of you. This is a problem for every alcoholic that quits drinking. He's got to do something with his time and his new energy. After all, you got a lot of energy, too. While you were drinking and bleeding from every pore, as we did, we didn't feel like much of anything a lot of the time. And our work was purely a matter of necessity. We only worked to get the money to buy the booze, to get sick, to pay the doctors, or buy the booze, and so on. It's this mad, mad circle. To me, the program of AA entails faith. Number one, I had faith. You have faith, I hope. Those people, I think, who asked for help have some sort of an idea that there is some hope, therefore they have some faith. Most of us do almost everything we do on faith. You buy a certain kind of a car because some friend of yours has had it and thinks it's a good car. You go to a certain church if you haven't been grown up in one. You go because something has been said to you. Some people have convinced you that you have reason to have faith in this philosophy. I think the program entails faith, prayer, the practice of truisms. With me, I was a Protestant. We aren't brought up very strictly in a religious way. My dad was a kind of a free thinker. He did a lot of thinking, but he embraced the Unitarian faith. My mother opposed him in it. So I didn't hear much about the whole thing except arguments at home in connection with religion. I was baptized in a Methodist church. However, when I came into AA and started to really think and analyze myself, I began to develop a faith, and I've developed a religion. The Serenity Prayer, to me, was not just something to recite dully and as a matter of rote. I immediately started to put this prayer into practice. There are a lot of things I couldn't change. I can't change the President of the United States, and I can't change the weather tomorrow. Then you work on down to the things that I might be able to change. Well, I wondered whether I should change my family life. Should I encourage my wife to go ahead and get her divorce that she had talked about? I decided that this wasn't good judgment. These are the things that you do in the first few days that you're sober when you start to think. Otherwise, you don't think. You throw all of these trivialities to the side. I decided there were many things I couldn't do. I thought these children deserved our combined attention. I felt that if I was going to gratify my own ego and bring them up to carry my name, I'd better get busy and try to establish some sort of rapport with them and do this as a family. This worked out very well. We've reunited in many ways, and the family and all have become a very fine, solid unit. The next item is work. And I mean busy work if it isn't constructive work. I think, I remember my kid Dave came home and one time and talked about busy work. I never heard of that until he was in high school. And this was the stuff of filling in blanks on pages and so on, things that really didn't do anything except keep you occupied. They didn't accomplish anything. You didn't learn anything from it. So I've always remembered busy work, and I think it's well for us to do things that actually don't accomplish much, just to put in time in a better way than getting drunk. It's better to put together a crossword puzzle or something of this sort than it is to get drunk. I prefer constructive work and have found constructive work to do. Well, all that's about interest and excitements and so on. Another thing is constancy of thought. To me, I do it today. I've done it all along. I've had some scares. In the few years, I've almost taken a drink. Fortunately, I haven't had a slip. And I say this is, I don't say this bragging at all. I think it's by the grace of God. Simply that something has occurred, some intervention has occurred emotionally or in some way, the phone's rung or something has happened which deterred me from taking a drink when I was all ready to do so. But I think constantly thinking, and fortunately the two of us living together are both active in the program and we talk AA a great deal. But besides this, we both have many outside contacting me. I carry a little black book with telephone numbers that are handy. And believe me, I always have. This comes out every year. I get a new one. I write all these telephone numbers down. These are people. All I have to do is dial Riverside 47328. He says, hello, this is Jim. I say, Jim, I need a cup of coffee. This is the only thing I have to do to tell somebody that I want to break the chain of what's going on with me now. I answer this type of call. I don't hesitate to ask for this kind of help. I think of us as a bunch of mountain climbers, and I say, as another item, use your rope. And that's what I said, that's what I mean by the little black book. I think we're all in a business together. The business consists of keeping you and me sober. People who climb mountains tie each other together with a rope so that if one of the guys falls, the other 10 or 12 on the string may have a good enough foothold to keep them from dying and falling to the bottom of the pit. We are in such a position, and we will always be in such a position. And the question is, do you know how to use the rope? Do you know how to do the thing that will break the chain for you? I've learned in people that I've worked with, and certainly in my own thinking, that I frequently reach an impasse that I don't know just exactly what to do about. My thinking gets so balled up and so disturbed by things which seem to be increasing in their importance that I don't know what to do. And I've found by some strange and mysterious help, the mere fact that I do something actively rather than to expect something passively to occur. I do something. Merely dialing the telephone, asking someone, maybe just talk. This breaks the chain for me and has, on several occasions in these years, broken a state of mind which might have led to drinking. A few times I've had it in my hand. I talk it, I sleep it. I think I've forced my way into AA. If people don't ask you to do things, don't sit back in the corner and wait for people to ask you to make the coffee. Just pry your way in. Go ahead and bludgeon in. Nobody's going to kick you out. You can always wash the dishes. You can always get on committee. You can do anything you want to. In fact, I've asked to be allowed to lead. I don't think there's anything wrong in that. Because for me to lead is just like to make a 12-step or to do anything that we do in AA. These are all positive actions which hopefully will do something for somebody else, but damn well are going to do something for you and me who performs the act. Don't become a fanatic. Don't be carried away. Now, some AAs do get too important. As you all know, some people get carried away. And this brings me to a very timely subject. I'm not going to talk long about this, and we're not going to have any comments from the floor, because the ceiling isn't strong enough to take the blast. Today's Saturday Evening Post, you may not all have seen it yet, it's just out, it isn't even on the stand downstairs. I guess maybe they were afraid to put it out. Down here at the bottom it says, Down with AA. This is the Saturday Evening Post. Now, my library on Mr. Kane includes it includes the medical economics. Now, this made me real mad. This is a journal circulated to physicians, and this reaches over 200,000 doctors. Now, he wrote an article in October 1963, Alcoholics Anonymous, Cover Up or Cure, by Arthur Kane. About 18 pages of it. I got mad and wrote an article. Before I sent it to Medical Economics, I sent it to Bill Wilson. He said that I might send my article to Medical Economics. They gave me this. Sirs, as secretary and the only officer of the International Group of Doctors in Alcoholics Anonymous, I take issue with the author of your recent article criticizing AA. The sole purpose of AA is to help the alcoholic. It offers therapy that supplements the help given by physicians, clergymen, and employers. All that AA asks from the medical profession is understanding of its aims and principles, and patience with the AA member who may be a little too enthusiastic. Recognition of the good that AA does and acceptance of the fact that AA will help patients in a fight to regain their health. Signed, M.D., Ohio. This is all I get in trying to argue our position against an 18-page article. Now, what I have to say about Mr. Kane. Our tapist, our recorder here tonight reminded me that Mr. Kane is a PhD, and I don't have to call him doctor if I don't want to, because I'm an MD. And just because he has a PhD, I don't have to call him doctor, and I'm glad. This man wrote a book that hit, it's on the market, sold for $4.95 by the John Day Publishers. And the title is The Cured Alcoholic. This is out of Playboy. I'm going to read it to you because I think it's interesting. Psychologist Arthur Kane tells us he was once an advertising executive. Who would doubt it? His book, in which he presents himself as his drunken brother's keeper, is a hard-hitting advertisement for the wares and talents of Arthur Kane. I couldn't give up on them, he explains, referring to some alcoholic soldiers in his company. I had to live with them and work with them. They were my buddies. So Kane abandons his advertising career and devotes his life to the treatment of alcoholics. Now, 17 years later, he claims to have come up with new concepts in alcoholism treatment and research. It is not at all clear what these new concepts are, but the heart of the matter seems to lie in the word cured. The orthodox view, as espoused by Alcoholics Anonymous, holds that the AA member is always, quote, just one drink away from a binge, unquote. Kane, however, insists that he has had alcoholic patients whom he has cured completely. They can now take a drink, he says, without losing a weekend. Kane's ideas are interesting. One wishes he would explain them instead of trying to promote them in a hodgepodge style and a tone that is alcoholier than thou. You're all aware that Arthur Kane wrote an article which created a great deal of controversy, first in February 1963 in Harper's Magazine. This stunned a lot of us because Harper's, we think of as a rather high caliber piece of journalism. I learned that he was paid $400. All I want to say is this. Those of you who are here don't need to be the least concerned, and I'm sure are not going to be concerned about anything that Mr. Kane or anything by one other single fanatic who writes for money. He's cashing in on drunkenness. Mr. Kane is mad. I mean, he's personally mad at people. I'll tell you who and why. Number two, he's jealous. Number three, he's greedy. Number four, he's an exhibitionist. Number five, he's wrong. In this article in today's Post, the thing which disturbs me about it, and the reason I'm telling you about it, is that you're going to have this to encounter when you get back home. Those pigeons that you've got floating on the edge are just hunting for something like this, and this is an excuse for them to fly away. Because he is so clearly expounding the idea that an alcoholic can be cured. He makes fun of AA, not only in this article but in the others. He desecrates those things which have a spiritual flavor. He says, in the beginning, they created Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a kind of a takeoff of that. He talks about Al-Anon. Al-Anon has become a network of women's auxiliaries devoted to gossip and chanting the AA litanies like Easy does it, a day at a time and so on. He says they look upon the 12 steps as though they were the 10 commandments. He says we consider the coffee pot the holy grail. And the worst thing he says is the cake and coffee served at meetings are not just refreshments. They are the body and blood of Jesus Christ to these people. Well, when I started in the practice of medicine, the first time I had a real outspoken enemy, a guy who really peddled my worst down the line, worried me. He talked around and he said I was no good and so on. And another doctor, a little older than I was, a fraternity brother, he's a successful doctor and he's made a lot of money in business. This man is a smart man. He plays all things good. Plays all things well in business and the stock market, and he's a good doctor. He said to me, Luke, you ain't got a chance of being successful until you got one real loudmouth enemy. He said, if you got too many of them, that's bad. But he said, if you got one or a couple of real noisy enemies, he said, then people will notice you. Up to then, they take you for granted. People will then run to your defense who formerly haven't given a damn. And at least they'll investigate you. And if you have nothing to be ashamed of, and if what this noisy enemy is screaming about is wrong, it's going to be found out. I think Bill Wilson has taken the attitude that we don't make any public fight about one noisy Arthur King. But we all have to face this thing at the grassroots level. We've all got the problem of tomorrow and the next day with people that we have to deal with. We must have some kind of an answer. Now, one of the things which worried me about this present article is he accuses, and I think on a very flimsy basis, he accuses AA for stifling medical research. If this were true, this would be very serious. If those of us in AA had the power to cut off money, he implies on the basis of one single incident. He says that a couple of men doing a research problem at Michigan had some information that they cured something like 12 alcoholics out of a group that they'd studied for 12 months. They wanted to publish this, and he says that Dr. Seltzer's funds were cut off to further his research by someone in AA who felt that this was bad propaganda because we wanted to promote the idea that alcoholism is incurable. Well, this is pretty wrong. We get in the medical profession a lot of circulars. Here's the Medical Tribune that comes every week. The AMA News comes out. I have all sorts of information crossing my desk every week. And I underline, I put red circles around everything that has to do with alcoholism. I just brought a current one with me that was on my desk yesterday. And the subject is enzymes said to speed ethanol metabolism. Well, ethanol, for your information, is whiskey or it's alcohol. Here's a man who has done a valuable piece of work. He reported in London recently, in which he thinks there's a difference in a dehydrogenase constituent in the metabolism of animals and of human beings, wherein the breakdown and destruction of alcohol goes through a faster and accelerated process in some people, whereas in others there's a lag and therefore a greater toxic effect. In other words, some people break it down and eliminate it through their kidneys, their sweat, and elsewhere, use it as energy at such a rapid rate that the amount of intoxication is relatively less. Now, there's all types of research being done at all times, and I think it's preposterous and ridiculous to assume that any of us in AA would be able to go to the health, welfare, and education department and tell them not to give more money to a certain project being done on alcoholism. This whole idea is so ridiculous and preposterous that I don't think we need to waste any more time with it. But since this is Saturday, and Saturday Evening's Post is out today, and the subject is so very timely, I felt that I must say something about it and get it off my chest. This is good AA for me, too. My blood pressure is lower already. Now, I'm very lucky, and I know it. I'm lucky to be alive. I'm fortunate in that in AA, I've had some recognition. We all like recognition. We all have ego. You hear sometimes people talking about ego, that it must be destroyed and wiped out. What these people mean to say is that we must revise our ego, put it in a different category, put it in a different level. Our ego is in a different plane. Our ego is something that we are proud of, that we have accomplished. The drunk and stuporous egomatic thinks he's the best bricklayer or the best brain surgeon or the best something else, and actually he isn't. He's lousy. But because he's drunk, he thinks, and he makes a phantom world and an imaginary world for himself. We all get satisfaction when we can look out over a group of people and see faces that we know. We have had some little part, at least. We maybe sat with this person and talked with him the first time anyone talked. Or we may have made some 12 steps and so on. None of us can take credit for anyone's sobriety any more than we care to take credit for his drunkenness if he happens to fall off. But we all know where we have had a part in a successful alcoholic arrest, or recovery, if you care to use the word. I use the word arrest because in medicine we talk about tuberculosis when people continue to live with the disease as an arrested disease. But we know they are never completely cured once they have had tuberculosis. It can break out again. I think of alcoholism in the same way. I've been fortunate in the jobs have been given to me which I could do and which I've enjoyed doing. As I say, I've had recognition. It's recognition to be asked to come here and talk to you, and I'm proud of this. I enjoy it, and if I can help anybody, if I can clear any smoke for anyone, and by talking, if I can help clear the smoke for me, this is all good, and I like things which are good. I've been fortunate enough, as you heard, to be made the doctor's group secretary. This means I write about 2 or 3 letters a week to doctors or wives or interested people all over the world. I have a mailing list of 350 doctors from New Zealand to Nova Scotia. Not many in Europe, but in North and South America and the points mentioned. We have a meeting every year, and these are exciting and interesting to me, and I have a good part in arranging them. This is busy work, this is good work, and I enjoy it. When I see, as we did this year, 20 new doctors who had never been to Doctors AA before, this made my heart swell with pride because I felt that maybe as a part of the work I had done, these people came. I have to prod them. Doctors are hard to break. I don't have to tell you this. They're a hard nut to crack. Doctors are arrogant about things which concern medical problems. They're difficult to break, and when we can convince a doctor that we have something for him whereby he can save his life, this is a big thing. Doctors are scarce, and everyone we can keep from dying of alcoholism is important to me. Besides these things, we have a home now, Harriet and I and our kids, and we're proud of them. I have a nice practice. I have a modicum of security. I feel that AA is my health. AA is my well. AA is my peace. AA is my hope. AA is my faith. AA has restored my faith in my God. Now, how will I spend the rest of my life? Well, I'm going to work. I expect to work as long as I live. If not in practice, I hope it'll be in AA. I intend to stay sober, and this is the thing which I hope of all things, that I may remain sober. I want to close with the lyrics to a beautiful song. I can't sing, I'm sorry. Del Sharbet, one of us, wrote these lyrics. You may have heard it. A day at a time, a day at a time. If you live it that way, you will find a wonderful, wonderful way of life and the thing we're all seeking, peace of mind. A day at a time, you work and you sleep. Do the things to be done in each day. And yesterday's cares will fade away if you take the time to pray. Pray for health, pray for happiness, that's all very fine. But the best prayer of all is, thy will be done, not mine. 70 are thousands of days, and you can't live them all at one time. But a wonderful, wonderful life is yours if you live it a day at a time.